Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. And welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, on Kingston City Council's final approval of the purchase of the Lemoyne Point Farm.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. With unanimous approval at their last meeting, Council finalized the city's purchase of the Lemoyne Point Farm property for $12 million. The property has been in limbo since the passing of owner Mary Fraser in 2022. In her will, Fraser granted the city the option to purchase the land at 95% of its fair market value, with the condition that it remain as much as possible zoned for rural use. The report from city staff provided to Council at their second March meeting detailed the largely behind-the-scenes process to get to this point. In May 2023, the estate trustees set the price at more than $18 million. The city disputed that figure, and a court application was made by the estate trustees seeking interpretation of parts of the will in 2024. A settlement was reached in February 2026, and the court approved the agreement to sell the property to the city for $12 million. The sale is expected to close in mid-April. Council formally approved up to $12 million in debt financing for the acquisition, with repayment to come from the Municipal Reserve Fund. Councillors around the Horseshoe expressed strong support for the purchase.
There's a lot of joy in the city, and I think they're in the council chambers of this being done, and staff did a tremendous job and deserve a lot of credit and the patience they had to have. And so I just want to echo that, and it's a reason to be to celebrate, really.
Briefly, I really think it's important that we acknowledge the Save Lemoyne Point Farm group. They did some really incredible advocacy starting back before the 2022 election. They were extremely patient. They were always respectful, both I found with council and with staff, which was really appreciated. And I really also want to acknowledge their initiative. They got out there, they held meetings, they were trying to plan some visioning, they were really trying to get behind what community wants this space to be. So while we're still a ways off from any of those kinds of decisions, thank you. Please thank your group, all the members, but particularly the leadership. You've done exceptional work here, and I hope you're really proud of what you've been able to achieve.
Members of the Save Lemoyne Point Farm group, who have long advocated for the land's protection, were also present at the council meeting, celebrating the step forward while also making clear their work is not over.
We will still be vigilant in the background, but I really want to congratulate the council. And for anyone here who might not realize, I've been involved for 35 years in defending that property, and some people in this community have been involved for longer than that. So there really are a lot of very happy people tonight. Thank you.
City staff say no immediate changes are planned, with future uses to be shaped through a community consultation process over the coming year. Local organizations and partners, including the Cataraqui Region Conservation Authority, have already expressed interest in offering programming on the site. The city says a more detailed engagement plan is in the works, with updates and opportunities for public input to be shared through a dedicated project page on the city's website. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to CFRC's Henry Walker with a story by Michelle Dory Forstell, LGI reporter for the Kingstonist, about the Transplant Advocate Association's local efforts to close the gap on organ donation.
Thank you, Dinah. A Napanee man who survived a near-fatal heart attack and years of serious illness is now using his experience to urge others to register as organ donors. Richard Hogan's story is being highlighted by the Transplant Advocate Association, TAA, as part of its Be a Donor Month campaign, which runs throughout April and includes events across eastern Ontario. According to a TAA release, Hogan was walking his dog on Christmas Eve in 2018 when he began to feel chest pain. What he initially dismissed as anxiety turned out to be a massive heart attack, known as a widowmaker, caused by a blockage in a critical artery, a condition with a low survival rate without immediate treatment. Thanks to his family calling 911, paramedics arrived quickly and rushed him to hospital. Hogan survived, but in the years that followed, Hogan faced a series of compounding health issues, including cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, and heart failure. A visit to the Ottawa Heart Institute in September of 2020 left him with two options: a wristy surgery to have an artificial heart pump installed, or a heart transplant. Rich chose the transplant, thinking it was his best chance at a prolonged life. According to the association, Hogan received a donor heart just 2 days after being placed on the transplant list, a turnaround that allowed him to return to daily life and be present for major family milestones, including his children's graduations and an upcoming wedding. Hogan has since become involved with TAA as a volunteer and board member, part of what the organization describes as a network of recipients, donors, and families working to raise awareness about organ and tissue donation. TAA notes that Hogan's story underscores a broader issue. While public support for organ donation is high, registration rates remain comparatively low. Ontario continues to rely on an opt-in system, a model donation advocates have long criticized as a barrier to higher registration rates. Data from the Trillium Gift of Life Network shows that more than 90% of eligible Ontarians say they support organ donation, but only about 35% are formally registered. That gap has profound consequences. More than 1,700 people in Ontario are currently waiting for life-saving organ transplants, while thousands more are waiting for tissue donations, according to the association. One organ donor can save up to 8 lives and enhance up to 75 others through tissue donation, the group said in its campaign materials. Still, many patients die waiting for a match. The Transplant Advocate Association, a regional charity serving Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington, and surrounding counties, says its work focuses on both awareness and direct support. Members, many of whom have lived experiences with transplantation, provide peer support and practical guidance to patients and families navigating the process, including what to expect before and after surgery and how to manage travel and accommodation costs. While transplant surgeries are covered by the province, the organization notes that many associated costs are not, creating additional financial pressures for families. Throughout April, TAA volunteers will host information booths, attend community events, and work with municipalities to promote Be a Donor Month. Flag raising and proclamation events are planned for Napanee and Kingston on April 7th, with local officials expected to attend. April 7th also marks Green Shirt Day, a national campaign created in honor of Humboldt Broncos player Logan Boulay, whose organ donation in 2018 helped save 6 lives and led to a surge in donor registrations across Canada. Registering matters. Ontario operates on an opt-in system, meaning residents must actively register their consent to donate. Advocates say that can lead to confusion, with some people assuming they are already registered based on past documentation that may no longer apply. In Ontario, registering to become an organ and tissue donor is a quick process that can be done online through beadonor.ca, their registration page. You must be at least 16 years old and have a valid Ontario health card. The process takes just a couple of minutes and involves entering basic information such as your date of birth and health card number, then recording your consent through the Secure Service Ontario system. You can also check your registration status to see if it still is active. If you'd prefer, you can also register in person at a Service Ontario location or by mailing in a consent form. Once registered, your decision is stored with the Ministry of Health, and it's recommended that you also share your wishes with family so they can honor them when the time comes. For Hogan, whose life depended on a donor's decision, the message is straightforward. Registration, he says, is what turns support into action, and ultimately into lives saved.
Thank you, Henry, and to Michelle Dory Forrestel of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little, LGI reporter for CJPE County FM, on a recent workshop for potential municipal candidates in the Prince Edward County elections.
Having an interest to serve your municipality is commendable, but what does it entail? What are the responsibilities of a councillor or a mayor? How much do they get paid, and how much time is involved? Only a few of the many questions potential candidates might have before filling out the nomination papers. Prince Edward County wants new blood in the council chamber, so presented a workshop for potential candidates last night, where attendees learned about the three levels of government and how they interact with municipal politics. They heard details about roles and responsibilities of the various key players and obligations of the councillors. As a bonus, two former councillors were present to share their experiences campaigning and serving as councillors and former mayor. The jobs of councillors and mayor are listed as part-time and thus reflected in the remuneration. The veteran councillors were open to questions and gave honest answers. Former Mayor Quaife didn't mince words when he said that 60 hours a week wasn't uncommon. Municipal Clerk Catalina Blumenberg tells us about the event. Catalina, could you tell me why you were running this event tonight?
This event tonight was really important to ensure people who are thinking about running for office know what they're really getting into so that they can make an informed decision. It's important to know what it entails, the type of work that they would be involved in, how the process works. Governance can be, you know, a big machinery, so what is that like? And just so that they feel supported, too, through their campaign process, and to know that the clerk's office is a resource for them and that we're here to help them through their campaign.
And what areas were you talking about tonight?
We went through the roles and responsibilities of a member of council and a head of council, the mayor's role. We talked about the municipal powers, the role of staff as well, so that candidates have an understanding of how that works. But I think what was really interesting and different about tonight was they got to learn insights from people who have actually ran for office and were successful and were on previous councils. And I thought that really connected the presentation portion of the workshop, and then to have that real firsthand experience to share their stories, their successes, their failures, and what surprised them about being a member of council. I really hope that this was an event that people can have true takeaways as they're thinking about running for office.
I asked a couple of attendees their reasons for coming to the workshop, and they had this to say.
Just curiosity. I was wondering what it takes to become a councillor. I don't know if I'm going to run or not, but I was just also curious to know.
But it's in your mind to maybe run.
Like I said, I was just curious.
And did it satisfy your curiosity?
It was interesting.
What brought you to the event tonight?
I just wanted to learn more about the process and honestly wanted to maybe make some contact with some people who were maybe thinking of running and seeing what they wanted to do for the county.
And were you happy with the event tonight?
Yeah, it was wonderful. It's always nice to hear from some old veteran politicians, and just to see some people sitting around a table wanting to make the county a better place.
Attendees felt they were satisfied with the information, but were noncommittal about running for office. For the Local Journalism Initiative, FrequencyNews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Up next, we have Juliana Gonsalves reading a story by Owen Fullerton, LGR reporter for YGK News on Kingston-led research on healthy shoulder motion.
Thank you, Dinah. Researchers at Kingston Health Sciences Center and Queen's University's Smith Engineering have released findings that could present a major step towards an evolved understanding of joint health and injuries. The first of its kind study in Canada is using advanced imaging technology to get a more complete picture of how the human shoulder moves, providing insights that could be used to make impactful changes in injury prevention, rehabilitation, and reparative surgery. The study was conducted at the Skeletal Observation Laboratory at Hôtel Dieu and uses biplanar video radiography, BVR for short, to accurately view the shoulder bones moving underneath the skin in real time. Aaron Lee, lead author of the study and former PhD student at Queen's, says that still X-ray images have typically been used when studying the shoulder, which forces assumptions to be made about how bones are moving relative to how the skin is moving. With a joint as dynamic as the shoulder, she says that often results in errors in the calculations made. What's really novel about this equipment that we're using is it allows us to see how the bones are moving directly, Lee said. Especially in joints like the shoulder, if you just feel your shoulder blade, you can feel that the shoulder blade, it moves a lot beneath the skin. The system used for imaging is not common, with the lab being one of the only two in Canada boasting the equipment due to its complex setup and the technical expertise needed to make use of it. Michael Rainbow, the director of the Skeletal Observation Laboratory and an associate professor of mechanical and materials engineering at Queen's, has previously used the imaging technology to explore the fundamental movement of the foot and ankle, another area of the body containing a bevy of different bones. Because of the complexity of the shoulder joint, it has been understudied, and Dr. Rainbow says that can lead to a somewhat misguided approach to injury treatment. This is the kind of research that allows us to revisit long-standing assumptions about how the human body works. Many of those assumptions have shaped treatment strategies, yet they were made before we could directly measure skeletal motion, Rainbow said in a press release. This kind of study is essential for designing better treatments in the future. Lee, whose PhD studies focused on shoulder motion and mechanics, says there are two primary goals to the research that could help reshape injury prevention and recovery. The first goal, and the focus of the published findings, is to discover and implement a better understanding of the function of a healthy shoulder, but that the imaging technology could one day also more closely explore the differences in shoulder function between individuals. It's mainly just generally what are the patterns we see across our samples, but then also how much does that vary across people, Lee said. On average, for every amount of 5 degrees you raise your arm, you might see 2.5 degrees of how much your scapula rotates. But with our technology, we can really get at that with more granularity and see if there is any differences across people, and we absolutely find that people vary. We're not all the same, and we don't all move the same, and that has relevance for later on disease progression as well. Given the rarity of these machines, individuals won't soon be able to know exactly how their own shoulders move, but the discoveries could help to inform treatment plans in professions like physiotherapy sooner than later. Lee says, with so many assumptions made about the healthy motion of a shoulder, some best courses of treatment might actually be damaging to certain individuals rather than helpful. She says the research could ultimately give the field more tools to work with to support more individualized recovery plans. With any sort of treatment, there are some patients who benefit from it and some patients who don't. So I think that this is the kind of research where we can get into the more individuality part of it and see how people vary. A lot of those assumptions are based off of how we think the healthy shoulder works, but really we haven't fully uncovered that. So we're kind of early in this knowledge to action plan, where right now we're trying to uncover, is there really such thing as this healthy movement pattern?
Thank you, Juliana. Coming up, we have a story by Keith Dempsey, local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, on Gananoque fire and rescue training. In a township defined by rugged shorelines, wooded trails, and hard-to-reach backcountry, firefighters are training for the moments when every second and every step matter. Members of the Leeds Thousand Islands Fire Service have spent recent days advancing towards their NFPA 1001 Firefighter Level 2 certification, honing critical skills designed to strengthen emergency response across the municipality. Last Monday night, crews from stations 3 and 4 came together for a focus session on equipment familiarization and off-road patient transfer techniques, including the use of utility task vehicles, or UTVs. The training reflects a practical reality in the township of Leeds in the Thousand Islands, where emergencies often unfold far from paved roads. Firefighters work through simulated scenarios involving injured individuals in remote areas, practicing how to stabilize, package, and safely extract patients from uneven or isolated terrain, conditions commonly found among the township's extensive network of hiking trails. Officials said the exercises are about more than meeting certification requirements. They are aimed at ensuring crews can respond quickly and effectively, regardless of location or conditions. With the busy tourism season approaching, the department officials continue to emphasize ongoing training as a cornerstone of public safety, ensuring both residents and visitors can rely on a highly prepared emergency response team when it matters most. In other news, a member of the Gananoque Police Service is being recognized nationally for his community outreach efforts, with praise now coming from both police and municipal leaders. Sergeant Mike Driscoll has received the inaugural Volunteer of the Year Award from Keep Canada Fishing,
recognizing his work connecting with residents through local programs. Throughout his career, Driscoll has been dedicated to serving the Gananoque community, particularly through initiatives such as Kids and Cops Fishing Days. The program brings together youth, families, and police in a relaxed setting, helping build trust and strengthen relationships outside of traditional policing. In a statement, the town of Gananoque also congratulated Driscoll, highlighting his role in creating meaningful connections with local youth and families while sharing his passion for fishing. The award was presented during the Toronto Sportsman Show, where Driscoll was recognized alongside others in the outdoor and conservation community. Officials say the honor reflects both Driscoll's long-standing commitment to community service and the broader impact of outreach-focused policing initiatives.
Thank you, Jesse, and now right back over to you with the latest in local sports.
Thank you, Dinah. The 2026 edition of the Queen's University Athletics and Recreation Color Awards were held late last week in the main gym of the Athletics and Recreation Center. The Color Awards recognize outstanding accomplishments on both the club and team level. Starting with the varsity clubs, the Queen's cheerleading team was recognized with the Award of Merit as the Varsity Club of the Year. 2025-26 was a historic season for Queen's Cheer, who took home a national title alongside the National Judges' Choice Award. Nathan Duffer Calder took home the Jack Jarvis Trophy as the top male athlete amongst varsity clubs for his contributions to the university's sailing team. Abby Lee of Queen's Lacrosse was awarded the Marion Ross Trophy as the top female clubs athlete. Night 2 put the focus on varsity teams. Jude Wheeler D of Queen's Cross Country was the Outstanding Performance of the Year recipient following a career season for the cross country and track teams. Wheeler D was named the OUA Cross Country Male Runner of the Year and was an integral member of the National Champion Cross Country Team. He also won 2 gold medals as a distance runner at the U Sports Track and Field Championships in the 1500 and 3000 meter events. Internationally, Wheeler D won a gold medal in the 1500 meter event at the Junior Pan American Championships while representing Canada in the summer of 2025, setting a new meet record. Quote, Jude will graduate from Queen's as its greatest male distance and middle distance athlete, said Queen's cross country and distance track head coach Mark Bomba. Queen's football defensive back Ashton Miller-Melançon took home the Jenkins Trophy as the Varsity Male Athlete of the Year, a fitting result for one of the most prolific players in Queen's football's 140-year history. Miller-Melançon ended his 5-year tenure with the Gaels as a 4-time OUA All-Star and a 2-time All-Canadian, and his final career interception total was 22, the most in program history. Miller-Melançon was drafted by the Calgary Stampeders in the 2025 CFL Draft and will be heading out west to begin his professional football career. The 2025 Gaels football team won the Jim Tate Award as the top overall varsity team. This comes on the heels of their historic Yates Cup victory over the number one ranked seed in the country, the Laurier Golden Hawks. This Yates Cup win was the first in 16 years and gave the football team a chance to play in the Mitchell Bowl against the Saskatchewan Huskies. They would ultimately lose that game by a score of 22-11.
Thank you to Jesse Bell for that update, and also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We start with Tuesday, April 7th, daytime high of 1 degree and a 75% chance of precipitation in the forecast, which, given the low top-end temperature, means we could see up to 3 centimeters of snow on the ground on Tuesday. Wednesday, April 8th, a little warmer. We've got sunny conditions here in the city of Kingston, but just a top-end temperature of 3 degrees, so bundle up if you're going to be outside. Thursday, April 9th, 11 degrees is your forecast with about an 85% chance of precipitation, going to feel closer to 7 degrees given all the rain. Friday, April 10th,
7 degrees is your top-end temperature with a low of 2 and about a 55% chance of precipitation in the forecast. Saturday, April 11th, the first double-digit day of the week, we've got partly sunny conditions. 10 is your high, but it's actually going to feel a degree warmer right around 11. Sunday, April 12th, 11 degrees is your high with an overnight low of 7. We have sunny conditions in the morning, but increasing cloudiness into the afternoon and evening. Monday, April 13th, daytime high of 14 degrees with a 75% chance of precipitation and an overnight low of 7.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.